Saxophone à la Permidi on the CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. Alright, before I play what I'm about to play, I just wanted to hop on and say you're tuned to CITR. I just said that. Saxophone a la Permidi, and I've got a commentary on American music queued up for today's episode, at least for the first half hour. So enjoy, and if you're up tonight, tune in at 11 p.m. for Saxophone la Nuit. Got some content from the Zilloopers concert and got a new era of rap music to play. But yeah, honestly, I don't know what I was thinking. Well, I did when I made this, but I hope you enjoy.
There was a lot of talk about the so-called music movement, avant-garde music, as Mama Baraka used to call it at the time, black music in the 60s. There was a lot of talk, and I heard it from all sources.
You're listening to Darius Milhaud's La Creation du Monde and William Grant Still's Fanfare for the 99th Fighter Squadron, both pieces depicting a sense of American nationalism, in a sense. You're listening to Saxophone a la Primitive on the CITR 101.9 FM. I'm here live in the studio with fellow saxophonist Caitlin Dara. Welcome.
Do I speak into this?
Yeah.
Hello.
And we're here to talk about some saxophone, so stay tuned. Right now, I have a rerun airing, so enjoy that while I get my laptop set up. But today's episode, I think I'm going to call it, like, American in Paris or something like that. But not George Gershwin's American in Paris. This is the real American in Paris. Anyways, for now, enjoy Sam Cooke, The Best Things in Life Are Free, live at the Copa, mixed with something. I think this is a Milford Graves interview, but stay tuned.
Johnson and you can go right on down the list, and of course I was involved in that, and most of us at that time were very active at a lot of different political events that was taking place in the black community, whether it was Bedford Stuy, whether it was Harlem. There was a lot of political fundraising, and a lot of people were very upset that we were told were very upset. Several occasions that if I don't start playing downtown, that the music industry was gonna just negate me totally, you know. But it was all this kind of talk. But anyway.
So what I'm gonna play here is something from an album called The Albert Ayler Story, and this album I found it on Apple Music, and it's The Albert Ayler Story, but it has a bunch of really important interviews. That kind of describe Albert Ayler in his time and also music in general at that time in America. So let's see if this works.
You know, so I started reading and everything was good. In the army, I used to practice, like, we would play, say, like 6 hours. Then at the end of that, I would practice at night hard. I would play, the scale, not per note, but I would just get one sound, and I'd play diminished and all kind of different things on the instrument to familiarize myself, hoping to be a great artist one day. But I was nothing then at that specific time in Orleans, France. But being in France, I could go to Paris. I could play at a club in Paris, and it was much different. So when I went to Sweden, that's when I started to going outside. I was working in a different kind of thing altogether, and the people said, beautiful. When I was in Sweden, the people said, beautiful. Then I said, oh, this is beautiful. They said, this is what you feel is beautiful. This is what you feel is beautiful. So I say, well, I may have something. So by them telling me this, it made me think, after I got out to army, to go back to those people to stay for a while, because they were like, you know, yeah, different, but they were like very beautiful musically to me, because sometimes when I would play, the people say, no good, I would cry, because that's all I could feel. That's all I could feel is what I play. So after I got out, I left Orleans, and I got out of the army in California. That's when I was in California, I started playing, and I met Red Fox. I don't know if you know Red Fox. Red Fox, well, I was playing, and he said, the guys, all musicians, black, said, ah. And Red Fox said, look, if you believe it, play it. That's what Red Fox said, you know? And that was like very beautiful. So after I got out of the army, I went back to Cleveland. And while in Cleveland, I told my mother, I said, I'm going to Sweden to live. Finish here, finish. Mentality stupid, finish. I'm going to Sweden. She said, you crazy. You can't leave me. I say, well, I have to go where somebody can understand me, where I was at, because I didn't quite understand myself, because the music hadn't quite formed in my head yet. I was playing it, but it was slow. It's not like it is now, fast, you know? It was slow, so I caught a plane going to Sweden. And when I got to Sweden, the Swedish people, it was kind of like that, so I had to play commercial music.
You're listening to Sax a la Primitive. This was a little clip from Albert Ayler interview,
talking about, I guess, his experience in Sweden, but also he did mention Paris. And so I guess the theme for today is an American in Paris, but like the real American in Paris, because I guess my beef with George Gershwin, specifically American in Paris, is that it's not an authentic perspective of an American in Paris, or at least what George Gershwin is trying to do. And I think this is just a common, this is just common knowledge at this point, is one, that George Gershwin is white, but also two, that George Gershwin used a lot of the conventional popular music that was popular at the time during the Harlem Renaissance, and specifically he was composing a lot of similar music that utilized, one might say, jazz, but one might also say African-American traditional concepts in music, in his music. But yeah, I guess my my issue is that George Gershwin isn't necessarily portraying a genuine perspective here, one, because he's white, and also two, because, well, some might say he's writing this music in homage to African-American culture, traditions, or music. I think it's important to give credit where credit is due, and I don't think George Gershwin necessarily did give credit where credit is due. And I also think that George Gershwin capitalized on something that was popular at the time, while not necessarily being sensitive towards what was actually happening in music at the time. And this is something that Albert Ayler, Anthony Braxton talk about musically and also vocally. So right now we're listening to Anthony Braxton's version of Come Sunday. We all know Come Sunday by Duke Ellington, prolific composer. But this is Anthony Braxton's Come Sunday at a recital in Paris in 1971. And it's completely solo. It's one of the most popular solo saxophone records. I think Anthony Braxton was one of the first to sort of do a solo album of this length. It's about 25 minutes. And if you've listened to Saxophone à la Permettie, Saxophone la Nuit, then you know that we kind of listen to music around the 70s, and that's important for a specific reason. And that reason, I guess I'll explain a little bit later, but Anthony Braxton, Albert Ayler, John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, all contributed to this sort of like new wave of music in America. Not only music, but spiritual awakening, social reconstruct in the 70s. And so, yeah, let's listen to a little bit of Come Sunday live. Caitlin might tell us a little bit about Beyonce concert, which just happened in Vancouver literally yesterday, which is crazy. And then I have more music and interviews to play that I think represent the real American in Paris. And I guess I'm going to also describe what that really means, American in Paris, because for George Gershwin to use that also as a title for his piece, American in Paris, I think is problematic. So stay tuned. Thank you. You're listening to Come Sunday, performed by Anthony Braxton, live in Paris in 1971. It's from the album called Recital Paris, 1971. And as you can hear, Anthony Braxton's improvisational style is very unique. I would say his voicing on the saxophone is obviously very charged, whether you want to say emotionally or whether you want to say, how would you explain it? Basically, you can truly hear like his raw emotion in the saxophone. How you want to describe it, I guess, is up to the person. But I feel like for a lot of black musicians around this time in the 70s, especially musicians who came from jazz background, at this time they're sort of moving away from jazz into more of the label of improvisationalist, musician, composer, and the like, because there was sort of this new movement in music where black musicians who were sort of labeled as jazz musicians were sort of freeing themselves from these constraints. But I'm going to play the next song. This is My Little Brown Book by Duke Ellington and John Coltrane. And Duke Ellington and John Coltrane are very important to jazz, of course. But Duke Ellington is also very important to American music and composition in American music. And I feel like that fact is sort of overlooked. There's a lot of composers that people sort of readily know when it comes to composition and symphonic literature in American music. For example, George Gershwin, I feel like, is one of the composers that a lot of people think about when you think of symphonic American music that uses jazz as a convention in the compositional style. But I feel like a lot of people sort of forget, and I feel like it's part of the reason why a lot of black musicians were trying to move away from the label of jazz, is that a lot of these black artists, composers, musicians were sort of overlooked, and they're sort of just described as, oh, it's a jazz musician. But Duke Ellington was actually a composer that contributed to the development of American music. Whether or not you want to say it's jazz, I guess that's up to you, but Duke Ellington contributed to so much more than just jazz, specifically symphonic literature. But this is My Little Brown Book by Duke Ellington and John Coltrane. Thank you. play some James Baldwin mixed with this. And that's partly because I feel like there's so much that I can't just explain to those of you that are listening, my fellow saxophone devotees. There's so much that I can't necessarily explain when it comes to music at this time in the 70s and American music, and why Black perspectives are so important when it comes to talking about American music and jazz in symphonic literature and African American traditions, traditional music in symphonic music, jazz, blues, etc., etc. But I feel like the art of these composers and these artists can explain so much just by listening. So I also put James Baldwin on here. This is called Inventory/On Being 52 Part 3.
Perhaps I should locate the tourney.
And then stop back and study the road I've traveled. Oh, I was in a hurry, but it was not after all. If I remember an ugly road at all.
Sometimes I saw wonders greater than any palace. Yes. Sometimes joy leaped out. Songs came out of rocks and stones and chains. Wonder baptized me.
Old trees sometimes open and let me in and let me. Along their roots down to the bottom of the rain.
And now you're listening to Tenderly, performed by the U.S. Army 76th Adjutant General's Band. And this is on the Albert Ayler Story album, which came out in 2014. And I feel like one thing, too, that is overlooked the participation of Black soldiers in the American Army. And this is something that composer William Grant Still actually pays homage to in his symphonies and in his music. And if you tuned in sort of at the beginning of my show, I was a little bit late, but there's a rerun playing that I had play that I called An Obscure Commentary on American Music, I believe. And in that I played, here, I'll just pull up the play sheet and tell y'all. So on June 13th for Juneteenth, I made an episode called Obscure Commentary on American Music, where I tried to sort of play, I feel like, authentic perspectives of what helped develop American music. And I feel like, of course, nationalism is very important to American music, sort of developing its authentic style. Of course, jazz, but not just jazz, but Black music that came out of the Harlem Renaissance. This includes like Broadway, blues, etc. Saxophone is also very important. Soul music, R&B, all of this. Improvisation. So in this episode, I had Darius Milhaud's La Création du Monde, which one could also say might be problematic in a way similar to George Gershwin, but Darius Milhaud is Parisian, I believe, or at least French, and La Création du Monde is kind of like the European perspective of saxophone, bringing in this new American style of music, which of course is connected to jazz in a way. But I mixed that with William Grant Still's Fanfare for the 99th Fighter Squadron. And one thing about William Grant Still is that he actually served in the Navy, and he writes a lot of music about his time in the Navy, or at least in homage to Black soldiers in the Navy, because I feel like, yeah, they're overlooked. I can't remember what it was called, but... Okay, he also has a piece called In Memoriam, The Colored Soldiers Who Died for Democracy. And you can find this on Naxos album, American Classics, William Grant Still, which has Afro-American Symphony, In Memoriam, and Africa, which is symphonic poem. And I guess by bringing William Grant Still into the conversation, I think it's important to recognize that while George Gershwin is well known for bringing American music this sort of new authentic style, I think it's important to realize that William Grant Still is actually the composer that I feel like people should be looking at when it comes to who was the most prolific American composer in terms of articulating a new American style at this time, sort of like leading up to the 70s during the Harlem Renaissance and a little bit before that. But I'll play a little bit of William Grant Still. This is In Memoriam, The Colored Soldiers Who Died for Democracy. And I guess one more thing is, I feel like a lot of people conflate Black artists and Black musicians' perspectives with jazz or being influenced by jazz, but William Grant Still, I feel like you'll see if you read a lot about William Grant Still, is that, oh, jazz, but he also draws from other areas such as nationalism and... he demonstrates a sense of American nationalism, not just from the perspective of jazz and soul and Black music that came out of the Harlem Renaissance, but also nationalistic music that sort of represents the American army, I guess you would say. So, in homage to that, this is In Memoriam, the Colored Soldiers Who Died for Democracy. But this is a little serious for this quaint afternoon, so I'm going to mix this with his Symphony No. 1, Afro-American Symphony. And as you can hear with the pentatonicism, he does draw from traditional African styles of music, and also African-American styles of music, specifically one that we all know, kind of like the slave hymnal, or music that slaves sort of brought into popularity, or it came into popularity, like the pentatonic scale, for example, from like slave hymns, which is hard to say, but it's true. And yeah, I feel like a lot of that is also loosely used by composers like George Gershwin, but the history of it is actually really deep, and I feel like you can't just use something like that without paying the right homage or without being insensitive. Anyways. Okay, so this is William Grant Still's Symphony No. 1, Afro-American Symphony, Movement 1, Longing. And you're listening to Saxophone a la Primiti on the CITR 101.9 FM. We're broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver, the UBC campus. Enjoy this, and then I'll be back with some receipts. And by that I mean I ordered some music from William Grant Still online. And his daughter, Judith N. Still, was kind enough to send over some resources, like some news articles from the time, it doesn't say what year here, but American Legacy Magazine, Volume 10, Number 2, that talks about William Grant Still. And the title of this is called The Symphonist. Against Great Odds, William Grant Still became a leading classical composer. So I'll read some of that in just a second. Thank you.
There was a lot of talk about the so-called new music movement or avant-garde music.
And I'm just going to play another interview. This is from the Milford Graves interview on the new black music from the Albert Ayler story.
There was a lot of talk about the so-called new music movement, or avant-garde music, as Mama Baraka used to call it at the time, black music in the 60s. There was a lot of talk, and I heard it from all sources. I heard it from white sources, black sources, you know, that there was a lot of people felt, a lot of respected people felt, that there was a definite political movement in this country to stop so-called, at that time they would call it, oh, they used to call it new black music a lot, was another term used. There was a political movement to stop the music. Because if you take at the time Sun Ra, if you take even Pharoah, you know, a lot of people don't relate sometimes to the new music, you know, literature-wise. But if you take Albert, Giuseppe Logan was involved in that, and Dewey Johnson, and I mean, you can go right on down the list. And of course, I was involved in that. And most of us at that time were very active at a lot of different political events that was taking place in the black community, whether it was Bedford Stuy, whether it was Harlem. There was a lot of political fundraisings, and a lot of people were very upset that we were told were very upset that the musicians were involved with so-called militant black leaders or civil rights leaders. It was told to me on several occasions that if I don't started playing downtown, that the music industry was gonna just negate me totally, you know? But it was all this kind of talk. But anyway, it was told by sometimes people who were considered reliable sources that there was a definite political movement to stop the music, you know? There was different movements tried, the musicians was trying to organize, but for some reason it was always being stopped. But the importance really that I feel about this music is that historically there was different times in this country from social, political conditions that caused this music to make various changes. And those changes was always in relationship to like the more or less freedom and the more or less growth of oppressed people. Not just black people.
Right.
I mean total, because there were white musicians involved as well.
That's right.
See, so
that's,
this is just not a black music. You know, it was a people's music.
Right.
It just so happens that there were the greater majority of musicians that was involved was black musicians. But this music was like a growth factor for a new awakening. And we all know that music is very powerful. It's a gathering force, you know. I mean, people, it's an indirect way to communicate to people. They get abstract thoughts before they start to condense them into something that becomes like a sort of logical kind of a way to do things. So I think that the music was going to direct people into another area of consciousness. So that's the very importance of the music, as compared to music today, that it doesn't work on a sort of conscious state that can, it makes you puppets, you know. You're constantly moving around in a circle where there's no kind of opening out, you know,
right.
You're caught. But, you know, like there were musicians in the 60s who had really came across something that maybe academically or technically didn't have a good understanding of what they were doing. That was made to think that what they were doing was totally, like, not happening because they couldn't, like, intellectually talk about the music. And I think it was a regression for a lot of people because certain people had a new kind of... I know one trumpet player, one of our greatest trumpet players from the bebop era, and I don't have to mention his name because he should be here. I mean, who else could I be talking about? Who we played on tour with in Europe, and I seen him, like, I mean, for me, it was such an inspiration, you know. And it was Dizzy Gillespie. When I saw Dizzy Gillespie sitting in front of my drums and I seen Dizzy Gillespie's head start moving in all kind of ways, that made me want to make his head just come off of his neck. You know what I mean? You know, because I said, go Diz, because, you know, I used to watch Diz do that. And I said, for Diz to be sitting in front of my drums. And next minute I know Diz was on the stage with his camera taking photos of us. So that was a hell of an inspiration. You know what I mean? New music too, you know what I mean? So anyway, I had this trumpet player with me. And this guy didn't know nothing about scales or anything, but he had something else happening on trumpet. I seen another musician hire him, and he came back and told me, he says, hey, Milford, man, I didn't know this guy couldn't read music, man. I asked him to read charts, and he couldn't read it. He said, man, when I heard this guy, I didn't know. I thought this guy, man, been to all kind of conservatories. I know another trumpet player, a great trumpet player today. I asked him when he got off the stage and told him all these high notes he was hitting. He said, man, what is this guy talking about? What high notes? This guy didn't know what he was doing. And that's what I hired him for. I said, hey, man, you don't worry about nothing. I said, just play, man. Because I said, and I know somebody else used him, that he definitely couldn't cut his music, but they wanted him for solos, man. Because this guy had another thing happening on trumpet, you know? And next minute I know this guy, but he's not functioning now, man. He was made to think after that he was not happening, man. Because there were some trumpet players, man, he's talking about, you can't play. And no, it wasn't enough of guys telling him, respectable musicians telling him that you do have something. So, I mean, what I'm saying is, sure, there were a lot of musicians that something was, there was a birth taking place. You know, the analyzation came after, and that's how this music started. It was a feeling that came out of the 60s that was opening up something, and that was stopped, man. It was squashed, you know? And that is the shame about what happened then.
You're listening to Saxophone a la Pyramidi on the CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. And you just heard Milford Graves talk about the new black music from an interview on the Albert Ayler story. And then in the background, we had Lil Darlin 1994 remaster by Count Basie from the Complete Atomic Basie, Count Basie Orchestra. And yeah, Count Basie, another prolific American composer. But let's get back to William Grant Still's Afro-American Symphony. We're at the end here of the first movement. And this is something I wrote about in one of my papers when I was studying music at UBC. The end of this movement, and William Grant Still was involved with the Harlem Renaissance, and I wrote that the end of this movement is kind of like a musical depiction of a proud black musician who just finished a gig, let's say, downtown at the Harlem Renaissance, when black musicians were finally being respected by the general public, white audiences, black audiences, and had a space where they could have their music appreciated by a wider audience, and not just be playing in clubs as jazz musicians, but some of the music was also being played on bigger stages and funded by bigger organizations. So as you can hear with the muted trumpets, we kind of get that vibe. And then with the harp, we kind of go into like this dream state, which I wrote was kind of like after the gig when the musician is going home and maybe going to sleep at night. And then we get this kind of like sad moment here with the strings, which I wrote kind of seemed like the musician reminiscing on symphonic music. And it's kind of sad in a way because while black musicians were being recognized, they still weren't fully being integrated into symphonic music, and they still weren't respected as they should have been by a genre that they were contributing to in every aspect, I feel like. And so this movement ends here, and then it starts with movement two, which is called Sorrow. And William Grant Still, Symphony Number 1, I feel like is so important to American symphonic music, American music in general. And I think it's important that people know the reasons why William Grant Still composed this symphony the way that he did. And I feel like not a lot of people even know about William Grant Still, and George Gershwin kind of takes the stage when it comes to talking about American music and even jazz in American music and black traditional music. Kind of George Gershwin gets all the good stuff when it comes to that. But William Grant Still, I would argue, is the more important figure that we should be looking at. And for many reasons, too, I feel like historically, George Gershwin has kind of been like pitted against William Grant Still to perpetuate this sort of unconscious bias and form of racism that is just more muted than it actually was at this time today. So, I mean, y'all have heard probably on past episodes my personal issue with George Gershwin, especially when we could be recognizing William Grant Still instead, or Florence Price when it comes to American music. But we don't have to go over all the tea, but there is tea. But I have a few articles here from the past that I thought I would cite. There's this one article that I have from American Legacy magazine, as I mentioned. It's volume 10, number 2, on pages 11 and 13. There's a section called The Symphonist, and it's an article about William Grant Still. And it starts out saying, in our society, the author is David Lander. And David Lander writes, in our society, even people who enjoy listening to classical music tend to be satisfied with the work of a few Europeans, all long dead. That makes the classical composer's profession next to impossible. And then this is a quote from William Grant Still, men ignore my efforts and contributions on all sides, William Grant Still once confided in his diary. And William Grant Still also has an autobiography called My Life, My Words. I think it was unfinished, but his daughter Judith N. Still contributed to it. And in that autobiography, he talks a little bit about George Gershwin, and Judith N. Still also talks a little bit about George Gershwin. And the tea, I guess I'll say, is that, obviously, I feel like most scholars might know this, but George Gershwin was friends with this really talented arranger that was known for being to arrange things just by ear. And fun fact, they would go to see William Grant Still's symphonies that were being performed by the Composers Guild and such. And then, surprise, surprise, American in Paris and a lot of other compositions came out of that. And I feel like they didn't necessarily credit William Grant Still. Whether or not they should have, I guess, is up for debate. But it is a little bit shady, in my opinion, them going to see William Grant Still's music and then obviously Gershwin bringing his talented arranger and then kind of like ripping off the music from this concert. I feel like it's very like blatantly, very obviously shady and capitalism at its finest, because obviously a white composer is going to be recognized more. Anyways, I feel like I'm cutting this short, but we're kind of running out of time for the episode, and my friend Kaylin's been here this whole entire time, and we kind of wanted to talk a little bit about Beyoncé, because it's kind of like current day stuff, but let me just finish a little bit here from these articles, and I'll just play something in the background. I have Otis Murphy here. One of my favorite saxophonists, and not everyone maybe knows this, but Otis Murphy's black, and he's like one of the youngest faculty members appointed at Indiana University when he started. One of the best saxophone virtuosos of our day, so, and he's my favorite because I think his tone is so beautiful. I feel like a lot of Americans kind of play with this like very bright, loud style, but Otis Murphy, well, he's American, he still kind of plays this like French softer style, which I personally like to play, at least myself. I like to play more in the French style, and since this is an American in Paris themed episode, I guess it kind of makes sense. Anyways, I'm gonna read a little bit more. He gives some background on William Grant Still. He talks about how his grandmother sang spirituals and hymns around the house, providing the child's first exposure to music, but he was more impressed by the recordings of opera that his stepfather, Charles Shepherdson, played for him. And yeah, William Grant Still takes a lot of inspiration from opera as well in his music. I'll skip ahead. Lander writes that after serving in the Navy at the end of World War I, Still worked for W.C. Handy. And W.C. Handy, if you didn't know, is like the father of the blues, and William Grant Still toured with W.C. Handy, experienced a lot of racism in the South specifically, but he arranged for W.C. Handy. He arranged the Charleston, which is a fun fact for W.C. Handy. Anyways, continuing on with the article, William Grant Still played oboe in the orchestra of blockbuster Broadway show Shuffle Along, which featured music by Noble Sissel and UB Blake, etc., etc. He was also, William Grant Still also worked with George W. Chadwick, or was a student of George W. Chadwick. And I guess another fun fact, I keep digressing from the article, but William Grant Still also worked for Black Swan Records, which I've talked about before on the show. I'm just trying to fit in as much information as I can. But George W. Chadwick insisted on tutoring William Grant Still free of charge because, of course, he was so talented. And Lander writes, back in New York City, Still learned that Edgar Varese, a French modernist composer, was searching for a Black American composer to tutor on a pro bono basis, and William Grant Still took this offer, but ultimately ended up rejecting the dry, abstract sounds of modernism, in the words of Lander. But one of William Grant Still's pieces, Darker America, was actually dedicated to Varese, and that piece kind of, I would say, is one of the most modernist pieces that William Grant Still has written. But there's more in this article. I guess I'll have to read it on another show because we're kind of running out of time. But I have so much more to read about William Grant Still from resources that actually came out at this time. So, yeah. But let's talk about Beyoncé, because I feel like it is important also to talk about present day music. And of course, my show focuses on music back in time, 70s, 60s until now, but I also try to focus on newer music, which is where Beyoncé comes into play. Caitlin, how was the concert? I hadn't even heard yet
how it was. It was good. I feel bad talking about it because I'm not like a huge fan of her. There's nothing against her at all. Like, I have a lot of respect for her as an artist, but I'm just not like obsessed with her. The reason I went is because it was my sister's birthday present, who is obsessed with her.
It was still
like a great concert though, but like my mom and I sat,
Honey,
like,
Balenciaga?
I don't know who that is. I know it's a dancer, but I didn't know which one specifically.
You would have known, but the solo, the big solo.
There were so many big solos. I think honestly, the best part about the concert was the background dancers. Like, I can't tell you the names of like the specific ones. I know there was like the twins. Blue Ivy did dance for a little bit. There's a couple of them. There's one girl with like really long braids, like they were almost to the floor. She was so good. Like, she was crazy.
Yeah, and also too, quick side note, ballroom, I guess.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, like, it was all super heavily inspired by like voguing. So I mean, her whole Renaissance album is like all house music, basically. They're like really explicit about how it's like a reference to all house music and stuff. And it was cool. I liked that at the very end, there's like so much dancing, a lot of voguing in the whole show. But I think like when she had a brief costume change or something, they had like three or four ballroom dancers like do like a competition and stuff, like go down with their unique costumes and stuff. It was really cool. There was one song, I forget which one it was, but I think it was off the new album, where... Yes.
Sorry, just play more fitting music here.
There was one song where she like name dropped a bunch of people, a lot of like inspiring Black female musicians. So like Diana Ross, Grace Jones, Nina Simone, like a ton more too.
Whoa.
Tina Turner. And I was just like, yes, let's go. It was really fun. Yeah, she's definitely a very talented singer. I don't think it was my favorite concert though. And wait, let me finish. No hate against her. It's because there's too much love for her. The stadium was like so, like she was singing so loud, like the speakers and stuff, the reverb, and everyone was screaming so loud that I feel like I didn't actually like really hear them like play that well because the speakers were like so, you know what I mean? Like if I got to, this would never happen in my whole life, but if I got to hear her play like a small kind of venue where the speakers aren't crazy, it's just like microphones basically for the singers, I think it would have been like the best thing I've seen in my entire life. But I think it was just like us sitting at the back. It was just, I couldn't really hear the song itself. It just sounded like noise from the speakers being so loud and like the
singing was like when I saw One Direction. Yeah. I couldn't hear anything.
Not that it was bad. Like, again, she's so talented. And like, I think it was a great show because there's so many props, so many huge, huge props. Like, there's a gigantic horse there was like a little tank that was kind of cool when they did like Run the World, and there was a giant Beyonce. It was pretty cool. Again, background dancers are probably the best part. She's an amazing singer, but I don't think it would have been nearly as good as like a performance, a concert show, if it wasn't for the dancers. Because she's not singing Adele music. They're both talented singers, but I think Adele has a vibe of you can sway and maybe sit down and like cry maybe. Where Beyonce is just as powerful of a singer, but the music is all very like you want to dance to and stuff. So I think the dancers did it justice. It was made it like a really good show. It was really fun.
Can we talk about how Taylor Swift tried to incorporate ballroom into some of her shows?
Why?
I know. I was like, someone was telling me about this, but it seemed like Taylor Swift was throwing shade because she also added more shows to her tour. So it seems like she's trying to one-up Beyonce. But it's like, I feel like Beyonce incorporating ballroom into her shows is like
it was intentional.
Meaningful it because was, of black culture and music and how it developed. Because obviously, and again, during the Harlem Renaissance, I feel like this is kind of like when this was all flourishing. But ballroom is like so integral to like the queer community and black music. And for Taylor Swift to just like use that, or just to like throw that into her show and just like have one really cringe like white person do a death drop on stage, it's like doesn't make any sense. Well, and also not paying the right homage to like whose culture you're
like,
taking
from. What's the point? Why? Like I said, like the whole show, the whole Renaissance album is like a super big reference and homage to like all house music and stuff.
Yeah.
Like I guess Harlem Renaissance of like the 70s, you know? So I also, maybe like, I don't know the details behind any of this, so like definitely don't hold me to this. But they had dancers of like all races and ethnicities and stuff. But I only really saw, I think maybe black dancers, definitely not white dancers, that were doing like the huge solos and stuff.
Wait, okay, so then it's also like also putting part them on of the spotlight. Honey Balenciaga, at least she's white. Very white passing.
I don't know what she looks like.
Blonde, light skin.
Beyonce's like that too.
That's true. But hold on.
I mean, I
Honey
like,
Balenciaga does like, is like famous on TikTok. The like pink suit with the like black skirt.
I don't know.
I feel like she might have had like a different outfit.
Maybe.
For Vancouver, the Vancouver show.
Like she sounds cool, but I don't know. The only dances like I really, really remember that stood out to me. The two twins had like a lot of attention doing solos. And then there's the one girl with the super long braids. Oh my god, she was so, I don't know her name.
Oh, I wish I knew.
But she was so good. And then there was like all the people doing the Vogue dancing at the very end.
Oh, Honey Balenciaga's Latina.
Okay.
But also too, like ballroom came not just from the black community, also Latinx community.
Yeah. But point is, again, maybe I'm wrong about this, but to me, it felt like she had dancers of all communities.
Yeah.
But they were really trying to spotlight the ones that were like black and stuff.
Okay.
Which I thought was cool.
I feel like that's cool because historically, we have been silenced.
Yes. It was a good show though. Like I really, really liked when they did like the names, black female artist names and stuff. I was like,
That's amazing. Yeah, what was the crowd like?
Oh, it was good. And like again, I'm not super in the know with all the Beyonce stuff, but my sister was telling me like in energy, this one song, she's like, Caitlin, you have to go silent. Or she goes, look, everybody go mute. She's like, you have to go quiet.
Was it? Did people?
It was quiet. I was I wasn't really that loud anyway, so I didn't. But it actually went silent. But it was silent for a while, so eventually, before the music actually kicked in, like, some people in the back of the place were like, But it was still fine. Like, honestly, there was still a good couple seconds of silence. It was pretty cool. And then there was, like, I don't know what song. There's one song. Oh, I think it was Love on Top. Where she sang a bit, and then she kind of just, like, stopped singing and let, like, the audience sing. And they sang pretty much the whole song.
Damn.
Which was kind of impressive, you know?
I love when that happens. Yeah. And I feel like people will be shady and be like, oh, the artist doesn't want to sing. Because, like, Mariah Carey's done that. But I think
also
it's
also, she sang like, for, like, 3 hours straight.
That
crazy
level
stuff.
Of fame, if people know the song, let them sing. Yeah, yeah, like, I would sing to Mariah Carey.
Yeah.
Like, I would sing to Beyonce.
Yeah.
I think it's so amazing.
She
happens.
Was very cheeky too as an artist. It was cute. Like she kept singing and then she would like hold a really long note and she'd be like yawning, you know, or like fanning her mouth. Just cute.
And Blue Ivy was there.
Yeah, she danced her bit too. I felt a bit awkward about it because like she danced for like 10 minutes maybe for like, I don't know what song, maybe like Run the World or some other songs. But I kind of understood why she was only on for like 15 minutes, because the rest of the songs were very like not appropriate for a 12-year-old girl.
Oh, which yeah,
I don't
yeah,
think
yeah.
she would care.
I like, didn't think,
but
about
I would
that.
Feel awkward if it was my mom singing yeah. those songs.
Actually, yeah. What?
So I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I'd want to dance with my mom to like her really dirty songs.
Okay, well, we have to go because I know it's 2:03. Okay. We did want to play more.
This is
music,
me, Caitlin Dara, saying everybody should go listen to Mississippi Goddamn by Nina Simone. We didn't yes. have the time today, but it's a good song. It's
next sack. Show. We'll be back next Tuesday, 1 p.m. and 11 p.m. So come on by to Sax. Oh my gosh, we have another show up right now. Is he coming in? Okay, well.
Shall we?
I'm going to introduce the next show. I think it's Lean In with Jeff, but I don't know. If he comes in here, I could. But anyways, enjoy the next show, y'all. Bye.
Bye.